Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Monday, October the 3rd. As we like to do once a week, we'll be chatting with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. You know, I remember an old story that somebody would open a window and he'd get punched. Then he'd go to the next window and he gets punched again. You sometimes get that feeling that it's like that right now. Every window that you open, there's a problem, whether it's here at home with the inflation, whether it's overseas. I mean, it's just one thing after another, and it's getting a little scary, to say the least, but very scary. So we'll talk about that, and we'll talk about the midterms and lots of other things. So let me say hello to our friend Bill Katz. How are you, Bill?
Oh, reasonably well. We have 5 weeks to go until the election, and either we will be celebrating or we'll be buying land in Australia.
That's right, one of the two. Well, I wanted to do this at the very beginning. I don't want to punish you too much and bring back a bad memory, but the Giants win the pennant. I don't want to bring that up. I know that probably hurts you a lot, but it was 71 years ago, Bill, probably about this time. The Giants win the pennant. Of course, the Giants beating your Brooklyn Dodgers to win the National League pennant. But you said you were in school, right, when you heard that?
Yes, I was in the math class, and they had interrupted the math class. This is how important baseball was in those days, to broadcast at least part of the playoff games between the Brooklyn Dodgers and the New York Giants. Both, of course, were in the National League. They were going for the pennant. And I heard what was then called the shot heard round the world when Bobby Thompson hit a home run off Ralph Branca and won the pennant for the New York Giants. My next class after math class was gym. And you went over and you got into your little gym uniform. And this time the instructor, the coach, Coach Deming, had a few things to say to us, and he wanted to talk to us about what had just happened, because apparently I was not the only person traumatized and near death. Others were near death as well. And he said, well, some things are because of skill, and some things are because of luck. And I thought to myself, boy, that's really deep. That's really right. What I need right now. We survived it. But, I mean, it was at the time. Really, the next thing, even losing World War II wouldn't have been as bad. I mean, to the people who were Brooklyn Dodger fans, this was the lowest it had ever been.
Yeah, that was must have been quite a moment. You know, that moment was voted number one, the most memorable baseball moment in the 20th century. Baseball.
Yes.
Moment. And so I remember watching that on the countdown one time. And it came down to that game. Now, your coach, who talked about luck, you know, it did help to hit the ball at Polo Grounds. That would have been probably a long out at most other places. So,
yes.
So that, yeah. So it you know, that home run or that swing and that ball were in the right ballpark to win a game.
And it was also the home park of the New York Giants, and of course Bobby Thompson, who hit them. Knowing the being a giant, he knew the park, and he had the feel for the park, and I think there was a little extra advantage. Now, it turned out later that Bobby Thompson and Ralph Branca became friends, even though they were on opposite ends of the... But it also turned out, even later than that, that stories came out about the Giants, or rather, the Giants were stealing the signs of the Dodgers. And the friendship became a little more distant when it became, at least possibly believed, that maybe Thompson had benefited from that. I don't know. But it was certainly the shot heard around the world, that was for sure.
Yeah, well, you still have to hit the ball, whatever it was.
That's right. You sure
yeah,
do.
even if you know what pitch is coming, you still have to hit it out. And
yeah.
it may help to know that it was a curveball or a fastball or whatever, but you still have to hit it out. I don't know. I've heard that story too, Bill. I've heard that story about stealing the signs, and I think they were stealing it from the apartments behind, right, where women were hanging their
yes.
clothing, you know.
Out in center field.
Yes, apparently there
were
some apartments.
Center field.
Yeah, back there. And anyway, but just wanted to bring that up at the very beginning so you wouldn't break up
on me. I just said something that may not have been accurate. I said they were in the in the Giants home park. I'll have to check that.
It was a home game. It was a home game
it
for
was
the
a home
Giants.
Game, yes.
That's no,
right,
it was a
that
home
ended,
game.
That ended it. Yes, that ended
that
it.
That ended it, yeah.
So,
bottom of the ninth.
Okay,
and
yeah,
it
was the Polo Grounds. I was right, yeah.
Yeah, it was the
okay,
Polo Grounds.
Well,
I think they had played, they had switched parks for the three-game series. And
yes.
The first one may have been at the Polo, the second one at Ebbets Field, and then the third one or something like that. But the final one was at the Polo Grounds. The Giants win the pennant 71 years ago today. Wow, what a... You know, I bet everybody who's got a grandfather from Brooklyn remembers that.
Oh, it was a day of mourning. I mean, we didn't know if life was worth living. That was what it was. I mean, these were our Dodgers. This wasn't just a baseball team. It was the spirit of New York. And to have this happen in such a blunt and direct way, I mean, couldn't we have been gently eased into a defeat
right.
by a softer? Have one home run. I mean, it was terrible. And yes, it was. And who was it? It was Russ Hodges who yelled, "The Giants win the pennant! The Giants
right.
win the pennant!" Russ Hodges was the announcer for the New York Giants.
Yeah, and that's a classic baseball audio. I think it's
yes.
in the Hall of Fame. They have it in the Hall of Fame as part of the history of the game. But what an afternoon. And it was an afternoon game. So that's the other thing that
that's
probably,
right.
I assume, started at 1 o'clock or something like that. And so by the time most people got out of work, they knew the score. So they were either happy or unhappy, I guess. It depends what side of, you know, what part of New York you were from, I guess. But, Bill, I wanted to begin. This is crazy what's happening in Chicago, you know, and I know we've talked about this before. But another weekend, another mass shooting and more people dead. Well, I guess this time it was only one child, but lots of other people injured. And this is happening every single weekend in Chicago, and
mm-hmm.
yet it seems like nobody cares. You get the impression that the citizens who live there, who for the most part, all of this happens in one neighborhood. I think everybody knows that. It happens in a particular neighborhood. Yeah, every Friday night, the people come in, they have gunfire exchanges, they get into fights, and then I guess it's over Sunday night. Every weekend, it's the same thing. People dead. We read about it on Monday, and then people like you and me are asking, how can this be tolerated? But it is, Bill. That's the sad part.
Well, yes, and that is a reflection of something that Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the late senator from New York and also former Harvard University professor, called defining deviancy down. He came up with that phrase, and it meant that people get used to bad things. You know, you live in a bad neighborhood. If it continues, you just get used to it. And the very standards you had before for wanting to live in a good neighborhood go right down the drain. So I think this is a perfect classic example of defining deviancy down. It's a terrible tragedy, not only in Chicago, where I went to college and remember the crime rate, it's a terrible thing for the country because it's happening all over the United States. There are many, many areas, citizens who now live in fear, where at one time they felt safe. It's happening certainly in places like Portland, Oregon, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and the gunfire is now constant and fully expected. And what is interesting is that not only are the people indifferent, but the mayor of the city, Mayor Lightfoot in Chicago, does not seem overly concerned.
No, in fact, she gets into arguments with people who ask her about this stuff. The head of the McDonald's CEO was talking about this, how he's having trouble finding people to work. And she said, well, you need to do your homework. Well, I think the CEO of McDonald's has done his homework. He cannot find people to work, Bill.
That's right. And also, he was concerned about the people in his executive office. McDonald's is based in Chicago, just walking the streets. People are afraid to go out, even in the daytime. And Lori Lightfoot, who is, as I pointed out, the mayor, was elected mayor as an identity candidate, the person whose identities made her eligible for the job in the view of the left wing of the Democratic Party. She is a woman, she is African-American, and she is gay. So she stroked off three boxes, which is what they're interested in a left-wing city. She qualified, and she's done really very little to stop this epidemic of crime. It goes on, and I think it will have to have a devastating effect on Chicago. People will leave Chicago in greater numbers, and you'll have, in effect, a recession or worse in Chicago as a result of all this.
Well, that is what is happening, actually. People are leaving. I mean, you read about San Francisco, you read about Portland, Minneapolis, Milwaukee.
New York.
I assume the same thing in Philadelphia. I know for sure that they've left Baltimore. And they take their money and their businesses with them. So they go to other places, and then left behind are, you know, city budgets that cannot hire enough police officers. Well, they also have a problem recruiting them. And this is what's happening. And you would think, this is the part that bothers me the most, Bill. You would think the governor of those states would take a different posture. I mean, if you're the governor of Illinois and your crown city of Chicago is falling apart, I mean, that's where most of the taxes and the visibility of the state is in. You would think that he would tell the mayor, if you're not going to do it, I'm going to do it. I'll put troops on the ground every Friday night to stop this carnage, if necessary. You would think he'd do that, Bill.
Right. You're absolutely right, but yet in city after city that is run by Democrats, there is very little expression of concern, in part because the very, very bad leadership of many of these black communities don't want it mentioned. They don't want people to think of their district or their city as a crime-ridden city, so they play it down. And these politicians go right along with that. They just play it down. There is no attempt even to have a summit conference with the gangs that are involved. There is no interest whatever in just recruiting and putting massive numbers of people on the streets to preserve law and order, and that would include, as you implied, National Guard troops. Now, I don't know what the law is on this and how it is applied, whether a mayor can simply call out elements of the National Guard. But if the mayor can't, that mayor can certainly request it of the governor, because that would probably go a long way to opening the cities up to its youngest people, because they would then feel safe in going outside and then feel safe in playing, soccer, where is right now they come inside.
Right. Well, I wonder, Bill, one more thought about this. I wonder if it's because they're not afraid of the voters. They know that the voters are going to reelect them, and they have for most of the last whatever time. I mean, if they were really afraid of the voters saying, no, we're going to switch, they probably would play it differently, but they know they're going to be reelected even if only 10% of the people vote, Bill.
That's exactly right. And again, one of the factors here is the role of the press. It is the role of the press to get us alarmed, They are supposed to be the watchdogs of democracy, but they're not that concerned. If the press would really go to town on the politicians and say, you must do something because we're going to report this, every detail of this story, and this is your city, I think you might get some result. But the press seems almost as indifferent as the citizenry and the who am I leaving out here? The citizenry and the government. The press in Chicago has a couple of large newspapers, the Chicago Sun-Times, Chicago Daily News, Chicago Tribune. They together could demand an anti-crime crusade, but they don't. And one of the problems you have with the press is today, much of the press is left-wing. That has, I think, been documented. They are not necessarily Marxist, but they're left-wing. And they feel that if they reported this extensively, the government might crack down with methods that the left does not approve of. So there are many complex issues here. But in the meantime, hundreds of children are dying each year in each of these big cities.
Mm-hmm. And look at Philadelphia.
Yes.
Carjackings are like way up. I mean, it's almost like driving a car in certain parts of Philadelphia is not worth it. You know, forget it.
That's
just
right.
Don't go.
That's
just
right.
Just don't go.
Well,
I heard, for example, Bill, one quick point. I heard that Uber drivers are avoiding certain areas. So like they see a request, let's say, to pick up somebody in a certain neighborhood, they don't do it. They just say, no, I'm not driving there. Because I don't want, it's not worth whatever commission I'm going to make.
Well, that's absolutely true. And this has happened before with certain services in large cities, that a constituency group within the city will simply stop going there. And the city is then lacking in a large service. I don't know how it's done, but African Americans are convinced by their leaders that they should not be worried about this, should not expect any special services, and that it will eventually go away, and if it exists at all. And that's a sad commentary for black leaders, because the black leaders are obviously training the African-American cities of tomorrow. And these places are blowing up, they're in flames, and yet there's very little comment, very little concern expressed even in these minority communities.
Right. That's right. No, it is a shame. It's an absolute shame. Now, I mentioned that the story of the guy who kept opening every window and he was getting a punch, that seems to be what's happening around the world. You have Iran, you got Russia, you got Ukraine. I mean, it just seems like everywhere you turn, there's a foreign policy problem for the administration. I saw this morning. I sent you the story this morning that OPEC is thinking about cutting back production, which is, I mean, that is so. You know, I don't care if they cut back production, but when we've got all the oil in the world, let them cut back. We'll outproduce them, and we could do that. And yet they're going to cut back, which means we're going to have to pay higher taxes. I mean, higher gasoline prices, Bill. I mean, this whole thing is crazy. I don't know who's when President Biden sits around these people and they're planning these strategies. I mean, does anybody have any common sense, Bill?
Well, everybody says, well, I shouldn't say everybody, but most rational people say the Democratic Party doesn't have any more common sense. It's become a party of ideology. The people really don't count. The people of the city or for the particular community don't count to these individuals in the Democratic Party. They have become not the party of the people, but the party of ideas, very bad ideas. To them, the theory of government is more important than the people who live under that theory. And the theory of government on the part of the political left of the Democratic Party is that high crime rates are simply indicative of a sickness in society. They're not indicative of more crime, because these criminals are fundamentally victims of the society. So when you have an administration in Chicago that believes the criminals are victims as much as they're victims, what are you going to do? What are you going to say? What's going to get done? Probably nothing.
Right. You would think that when they're sitting around, Bill, discussing, for example, energy policy, that somebody would say, you know what, yeah, I agree with you about climate change, but, you know, it's probably not a good idea for people to pay $6 a gallon. If that's what we have to do, if that's the only way we can do something about the climate, maybe there's something else we can do. Maybe we can slow it down a little bit. And instead of the world disappearing in whatever, you know, 20 years, let's slow down a little bit and take, you know, let's have a more balanced approach, Bill. I guess that's what I'm trying to say
about climate change.
But they don't seem to care, like you say, Bill.
I think that's an excellent idea, a more balanced approach. You know, I was reading a couple of days ago that the actual total gain to the environment from banning fossil fuels will be 50%. In other words, the replacement energy devices will have 50% of the pollution of gasoline. Now, I had been led to believe in the past that these devices, electric cars and things like that, will eliminate the problem of pollution from vehicles. But no, it'll only be down 50%. And my question is, we're an ingenious country. We went to the moon. We're going again. Isn't there a way of making the current systems within the energy system work more efficiently and get the 50% that way, rather than wrecking the petroleum-based industry and throwing it into the chaos it's in today? I mean, if we can reduce pollutions and emissions by the same percentage level as can electric cars, for example, or 50%, maybe that's where we ought to go and not completely revolutionize things, getting to a level that we could reach in other ways.
That's right. And I bring this up about gasoline, Bill, because not only is OPEC talking about cutting back production, but also that pipeline exploded, and we're not sure who did it. I don't know if you have any more information as to who did it, but it's going to have
no.
an impact. It's going to have an impact on European countries, because as I understand, a lot of their natural gas or gasoline or oil, I mean, was coming through there. So that's another, you know, another probably increase in the price of gasoline. And I go back to the point I made before. We it shouldn't even concern us, because we have all the energy. I mean, between Texas and Alaska,
yes.
we could probably take care of the world. We could probably...
That's right.
Between Texas and Alaska, we have enough oil to keep everybody happy. And do it cleanly, too. Do it cleanly.
Yes.
We don't have to pollute on purpose. And yet,
well, that's
no,
the point.
We're all scared
point.
About going to war over oil.
We have the capacity to solve the energy problem for us and our allies by simply going back to the energy policies of the Trump administration, which did include fracking, which is a very controversial action, because that and 40 other reasons will end the world. But we could do that. We could increase our production. The emissions would not make that much of a difference because they're down fairly low already through catalytic converters. But we could do it and save ourselves all this tragedy, which no matter what we do may end badly anyway, because we're not so sure that these green energy devices and practices will do the job. It's only a theory.
Only a theory. That's exactly right. And,
yes.
you know, we saw some of that here last year, Bill, when those, whatever they're called, didn't work in the winter.
Wind farms, yeah.
Yeah, the wind farms,
yes,
they didn't
right.
work. And, you know, so we were relying on it. It didn't quite work that way. So, I mean, I'm not really as ideological as, I mean, I guess I'm more practical when it comes to energy.
That's
what I'm saying. And my feeling is,
well,
you know, hey, let's make sure that we've got gasoline to run our country and to run our industry and to keep everybody happy. And yeah, we can do the climate change stuff. You know, we can make sure that the gasoline is clean. And it is. I mean, the cities today are cleaner, Bill. You know this, than they were 30, 40 years ago. And
yes.
I was talking to a gentleman the other day who was saying that that was the amazing thing when he went to L.A. He went to L.A. in the 60s or 70s, and the air was horrible. You go to L.A.
Sure.
now, and things are a lot better.
Oh, we've made a lot of progress in improving the environment. That's why I say this is such a fanatical policy that is being imposed on us through the Biden administration, that we must eliminate all burning of fossil fuels. And they've also turned down nuclear energy. I don't know where they think the electricity is going to come from, even to charge the electric cars that they want us to buy at a price that very few Americans can afford.
Right.
There is lacking that practicality that you talked about. One of the geniuses of the United States is that it's a practical country. It's not an ideological country. And
that's
it
right.
is becoming less practical every day as a result of these policies. And you wonder what the possible gain could be, but then you look at who is running the Democratic Party. It is the political left. And to them, as I said before, people don't count. Only the ideology counts.
That's right. That's right. You would think that, as I said before, that somebody would take a look at the big picture and say, you know what, we need to bring down the volume on climate change and let's ease up a little bit on that because, you know, the country is hurting. The country is hurting. These gasoline prices are killing people and they're going to go up. But you would think that they would think like that, Bill. But I guess, like you say, we don't have practical people anymore in the Democrat Party. The other point, Bill, that I wanted to make is that you would think for a man who was elected, frankly, in very small numbers. I mean, the election, the 2020 election was decided by, I think, 100,000 votes in five states. He has a 50-50 Senate. He lost seats in the House. You would think that somebody would tell President Biden, you know what, you don't really have a mandate. So don't try to govern like Roosevelt because you don't have that mandate that he had. Try to be a little bit more practical in your
yes.
governing and make sure both sides get something. But he's not governing like that, Bill.
Yes, and that gives rise to theories, rumors, some of which may well be true, that he's not his own man, that he is taking orders from other elements, that he does not have the individual political power to impose a more practical view. You almost have to believe that because when you look at some of his appointments in office, they're the same people who were appointed to the Obama administration. Usually a new president, even one of the same party as the old president, wants all his own people. But there are plenty of representatives of the Obama administration in this administration, and I think they are probably calling the tune.
Oh, they are. There's no question in my mind because – you know, this is not the Joe Biden that we knew for 50 years. I mean, look, he was not the brightest guy in the world, but he was not a radical either. He was not a radical left-winger. He was kind
That's
of
right.
a, you know, left-center kind of guy, but he was not a radical left-winger. And, you know, what we're seeing, like you say, these appointments, I mean, like these people going in front of the Senate and saying that men can get pregnant. I mean,
yes,
you have to ask, you know, where's he finding these people? You know, that's crazy to say something like that. That's not political. That's just crazy for people to say
yes,
that.
He's talking about a biological variation, which is accurate in certain respects. It applies to very few creatures. And it is not something upon which you would base a policy. That's the thing.
No.
They look for these ways of becoming abnormal in their policy views, and they find them, unfortunately.
Yes, and then they wonder why we think they're strange, Bill.
I'm afraid you're
right. Yeah. We'll take a little break, and we'll be back with our friend Bill right after this. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, chatting with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Bill, you've been covering Iran quite a bit on Urgent Agenda. What can you tell us today? I know they've been marching a great deal, But that's another one of those problems that I was talking about before. But they've been marching in the streets quite a bit, and the people are showing some tremendous courage by marching. You know, I've always said this, that it takes no guts to march in the United States against your government.
Yes.
But it takes a lot of guts to march in Iran or Cuba or, well, wherever you have a real repressive government. And those people are marching. They're not afraid, Bill.
And when you see that courage, you have to be tempted to join with them, if only verbally. No one is suggesting that we send troops to Iran. But I do think that the people of the country, of the world, would be a lot happier if we took a much firmer stand with the mullahs of Iran. Instead, we're negotiating with them over their nuclear policies, and our negotiations have leaned in their direction. It seems that not only we will not take a very firm line on the Iranian government because of what is going on in the streets right now, not only that, but we will negotiate with them in other areas. We will treat with them in other areas. We are, in our relations with Iran, bizarre and weird and completely unprecedented. You don't treat an enemy with this kind of kindness, and we are.
Right. And you're right. You would think that, you know, the president of the United States could make a statement, say, I am recalling, I'm not sure if we have relations. I don't think we have relations with Iran.
No,
not right now, yeah. But I am, you know, taking, you know, tough diplomatic measures, maybe sanctions. We're going to stop negotiating, maybe go after banks and stuff like that. You would think he could do that. He would have the power. I think he would enjoy, you know, public support in the Congress from that, from many Republicans, to say the least. But no, he's watching again, Bill. This man, this President Biden, he's great at watching things, Bill. He's like the guy
so sitting
in the bleachers. He's not in the game.
That's right. He is very great at watching. He is, in fact, I think he has awards on the wall for his outstanding watching throughout his political career. And if he gets tired watching, he could always turn the watching over to Kamala Harris, who will watch and see things that aren't happening. So watching is a very big thing, very big thing. I respect that. I've always respected a good watcher.
That's right. That's right. At a time of crisis, there's nothing like somebody watching. You know, it's just a perfect time for a president to sit back and just watch. Now, you must have read my mind, Bill, because my next topic was Vice President Harris, and then we'll talk about the midterms later. But I guess we have a great relationship with the people of North Korea. Did you know that, Bill? Well, with the People's Republic or whatever their name is. He got those names wrong. And
It was she.
She did, yes.
It was Kamala Harris, yeah.
You're right, Kamala Harris.
Yeah,
that's what I meant. I misspoke.
Yes.
I meant she.
That's
but
right.
What amazes me, Bill, she didn't notice when she was saying this.
No, I watched her say it. The tape has been run many times, and as if she had no idea what she was saying. It was like an automaton. You know, she has been given something to read or memorize. It may have even been on a teleprompter, and she went right through with it and did not even pause to correct her mistake. I mean, I do hope she knows by now that our relationship is with South Korea and not North Korea. I'd hate to have her as a commander-in-chief in the armed forces and have us bomb the wrong country, because that seems to be, you know, another excusable error for this crowd.
Yeah, I mean, it's just unbelievable. I mean, I can understand, you know, it's the same thing with President Biden saying, where's Jackie? Look, these things can happen. I'm not going to be a jerk about this. You can, if you're the president of the United States, maybe you can forget somehow mistake that somebody passed away or was killed in a car crash 6 weeks ago. I'm going to cut him a little slack on that.
Okay.
But here's the beef I have, let's get back to Vice President Harris. We'll talk about where's Jackie. But what I wanted to say is that if you and I were reading that speech, we would say, oops, I made a mistake. I'm sorry. Forgive me. Of course I meant
that's
to say.
That's right. There would be some alertness to what you're actually saying. You had the feeling she wished she was somewhere else and wished she was saying something else.
And that she was just, like you say, reading a speech.
Yes, she never seems terribly interested in what she was talking about or in even doing her job generally.
Right.
She seems to be the wrong person for that job, and I think it may very well be because she resents being in the number two position. Remember, she ran for president herself, and Biden was the winner of that particular contest. So she may be more resentful than proud.
Right. We'll get to where's Jackie in a minute, but there is something else that Vice President Harris said in the last couple of days where she said that, I'm paraphrasing, that help for the victims of the hurricane or the problem down in Florida was going to be by communities of color or something
outrageous
like that. And that's also created,
yeah.
I mean, I remember when they used to call that racism, Bill.
Yes. Well, that's it. I mean, that is open racism. She says, well, they are hurting more. Not necessarily. In some communities of color and poor communities, they probably handled it well and are in a pretty much the same situation as others. But what he said was, we must think of equity here. No, we don't. We have to think of saving lives and saving
right.
homes. This is not a time to discuss equity. But she was obviously playing for to her constituency,
mm-hmm.
and the White House took a black eye because
right.
nobody likes that policy.
No, and the White House has not come out saying what a great speech that was, you know. But I got the feeling that when she was doing the North Korea thing, she was reading, but when she was doing the equity thing, she was talking out loud. That's the impression I had, that she wasn't reading a speech. In other
yeah.
words, that's kind of what we saw in that equity comment is
yes.
Kamala Harris, the very liberal senator from California, Bill.
Yes, doing her thing. And
right.
saying the things she said so often that she doesn't even stop to think of their meaning. I think that
right.
would be an accurate interpretation. Whatever it is, she has an obligation to apologize and to correct herself. Just for the record of American foreign policy, she hasn't done so. She doesn't care. And not caring is not who we want in the Big Apple right now.
No, not especially when a tragedy like the one in Florida. Now, let me get back to where's Jackie, the comment by President Biden. I think what was really bad in that whole story, Bill, is the way the press secretary handled it. Had she just come out the next day and say, look, I'm sorry, he made a mistake. You know, we're very sorry. He called the family to apologize. It was a
yes.
you know, big mistake, and the president knows, and he apologizes. But they start going off on these explanations that I guess he had Jackie on his mind, like that famous song, Georgia on My Mind, you know.
Georgia,
oh, I got Georgia on my mind. Yeah. Who was the singer of that? Ray Charles, right? Yeah, Ray Charles.
Ray Charles.
Yes, I got Georgia on my mind, and I guess he had Jackie on his mind. And instead of just saying he made a mistake, it happens to, well, I don't know. I guess it could happen to people. I don't remember happening it to me lately, but I've seen people forget things, especially
yes.
older people forget things. And not the end of the world. They can apologize. I mean, my late grandmother, used to get my wife's name confused with a former girlfriend.
Uh-huh.
And every time that we would walk in the room, she was calling her the other name. And
I want to see that scene in the movies.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, after a while, everybody would be laughing. I was
sure.
laughing. My wife was laughing. Everybody was laughing. But my late grandmother, she didn't know what was going on, so she's saying, why is everybody laughing? I'm just asking where she is, or
yes.
I just said her name. So, I mean, we've all had people in our family who do that, but they don't have their finger on the nuclear button, Bill.
That's exactly right. And, you know, you can take a simple gaffe like the one that Kamala Harris made in South Korea and use the term North Korea. And if she had interrupted herself and made a little joke of it, she would endear herself to the people. But not only didn't she apologize, nobody apologized on her behalf, and nobody directly corrected her.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. You know, no one is asking that she be humiliated in public, but nobody even corrected her. I think several of the heads of agencies and maybe smaller agencies in Washington had a few things to say, but that was about it. Here was a case where Biden did have an opportunity and an obligation to enhance the role of his vice president, who, after all, may be the party's nominee for president, simply by saying, making a joke out of it and saying, I know that Kamala is completely with us.
Right. Or he could have said something like, I just fired the speechwriter.
Yes.
You know, I just fired the speechwriter who wrote that. And we need better quality control in her speechwriting department or something like that. You know, but again, you know, she was not in, you know, not at all impacted by what she said. And that's what is surprising to many of us. Well, I got two big topics left, Bill, that I wanted to get into. One is the midterms. But before we get there, very interesting thing that just happened in Georgia, where you remember the Voting Act law or whatever the reform, whatever it was. Where the commissioner came in and moved the All-Star game. Very stupid move. But anyway,
yes,
that was supposed to be Jim Crow 2, if you remember. That was supposed to be the 21st century version of Jim Crow. Well, a judge appointed by President Obama said, no, there's nothing wrong with the law. It's perfectly nice or perfectly constitutional.
Yes.
Amazing,
Stacey Abrams. And Stacey Abrams was involved in that case. Her side lost, and she declared victory. I mean, she's learning well how to work for Vladimir Putin. You know, I mean, it's we lost how many? We won. That's all. And the fact is, there are a certain number of people who will believe her. Stacey almost just about won. Yep. Mm-hmm. That's right.
That's right.
I saw that too. Just absolutely no sense of graciousness. She should say the court has spoken. We will abide by the law, but we will continue to oppose it. A dignified statement would have been so much better than the nonsense we heard and the pseudo silence that we heard.
Right. I'm sure that she will say or join other liberals in saying that the courts are losing their credibility. You know, because they're writing opinions that we don't like.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, it's bizarre to suggest that the Supreme Court loses credibility because some of its decisions are not in the majority. That's one of the purposes of a court, is to be neutral and gather the facts and judge those facts as they are, not by some theory. But, yes, this attack on the Supreme Court by the New York Times yesterday was extraordinary, and I think what they're doing is they're setting up the American people for their advocacy of packing the court, which I think is coming.
Right. Yes, that's correct. They'll say that that's the only way we can save democracy.
Right.
You know, a team saying the only way we can win the game is if the other team, if we get five outs, we have to have five outs. That's the only way we can win the game. But you know, that's where the Senate comes in, and let's talk about the midterms for a second. I've heard people say that the House bill is likely to go Republican, that it could be 15 to 50 seats. I mean, that's the range I'm hearing. It'll likely go Republican, very likely to go Republican, but it could go 50 to 50 seats. So it depends on the turnout. The Senate, I guess depends who you listen to. Right now, RCP is projecting the Republicans plus two, or a 52-48 Senate. They're saying that the Republicans will keep PA, Pennsylvania. They'll win Georgia, and they will win Nevada, and that's where the 52 come in, Bill. That's what I'm hearing. I don't know if that's right or wrong, but that's what they're putting out there, Bill.
Well, we'll know after Election Day which pollster was right and which pollster was wrong. I'm very apprehensive over the elections. I think that there are things about the electorate this year that the pollsters don't know or haven't studied. There have been years when many polling organizations get things almost exactly right, and there have been an equal number of years when polling organizations are way off. If you listen to the polling organizations, the Democrats will squeak through in controlling the Senate and will win the House. But I don't know. And the reason I don't know is the electorate seems so unusual this year. We've gone through a pandemic. We've gone through a trauma like that. I'm not so sure they're thinking in the same way they usually think. I'm not so sure that the people who are polled are even giving correct answers. I think some may be afraid that somebody else, some nefarious character, is reading the poll results and knows their name. I think I've read several articles to that effect, that the American people are just not confident to be polled. They're not confident in what's happening, and they wish they were.
Yeah, a lot of people are afraid. This is what this is the theory of this fellow who runs the Trafalgar Group.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, I saw him interviewed on over the weekend, and that's his theory. He says that there are, I think he called them underground voters. People,
yes.
They don't put any sign on their front yard. They don't have a bumper sticker. They don't talk politics. But they're going to vote, for sure.
Yes. And they're going to vote heavily Republican, in his view.
That's what he's saying. Yeah, that's what he's saying.
Yes. That's Nixon's idea of what he called the silent majority.
Right, exactly. And whether that's true or false, I don't know. Nobody really knows. We'll know on Election Day. But one thing that puzzles me is when I see these polls, you know, 1+5 Republicans and +6 Democrats. I mean, that doesn't make any sense to me, Bill. Either they're sampling different people or what they're doing, I don't know. But you would think that very sophisticated pollsters would be pretty close to each other in what they're projecting if they're doing their work correctly, which is to get a good sample and ask the right questions. But sometimes they're so far apart. You know, you have a situation in Pennsylvania where the governor there is running for I'm not sure if he's running for re-election, but the Democrat is running for election. Yeah.
Yes,
Shapiro,
Democrat,
right?
Running for election. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he's ahead by like 11 points in most polls.
Right. And people are saying, how can that be in a state that is heavily divided? I mean, that he win by 2 or 3, I get it. But that he would win by 11, and then the race for the Senate is nearly a tie. So does that mean people are splitting tickets? I don't know what it means. It's weird.
Well, I think in the case of the Pennsylvania race, the Senate candidate, Dr. Oz, is not a particularly great candidate. He is the candidate of Donald Trump. He is a Trump ally. That complicates things also because people don't know how to poll the Trump factor. How much pull does Donald Trump have in this election? And they can't be sure until the election is over, which doesn't do as much good in terms of prognosticating. But the thing with the polling is that there are theories that hold that the polls tend to favor the Democrats because the polling organizations are allied with Democratic journalistic organizations or pro-Democrat elections organizations, and that the likelihood will be that the Democrats will do better than the polls. That happened, I think, once. There are other theories that hold that the country is moving to the right and that the Republicans will do better by a greater margin than the polls now show. Obviously, we here can only speculate, but the uncertainty of the polls is adding, I think, to the anxiety of the American people.
Right, and then you see a poll that came out of the state of Washington where the Republican candidate is within 2 points of the incumbent senator.
That's
well,
right.
If that's true, then the theory of turnout is correct. So I don't know which way it's going to go. I mean, I remember my late father had a phrase. He said that there are more pollsters in the United States than gasoline stations. And
that's
it just
probably
seems like,
true.
You know, there are so many different polls coming out. It seems like there's one every day that comes out.
Yes.
I just don't know. I don't know how they can talk to that many people. I mean, that's come up with a sample. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Some of them use electronic polling where there are I think Rasmussen actually does it, where you're called by an automatic machine. And when you give an answer, it will register on that machine, and it's read at their headquarters. But I think you're absolutely right. they have polls, and they will tell you what the sampling is, of course. 1,500 likely voters, 1,500 registered voters. From what I understand, and I think it's been true over the years, the figure you always want is the likely voter figure, because people who are uncertain and may not vote are not terribly useful to you. And those votes were shown earlier in the year, the true likelies, that the Republicans were going to have a blowout on their behalf. That was called back not too many months ago by many polls who said, wait a minute, from what we're seeing out there, the country is moving toward the Democrats. Now we're being told that many of these institutions that were moving to the left in the polling are moving back to the center, that they're moving more in the Republican direction. So, like you, I don't know, we're going to have to wait till election night.
Yes, we're going to have to wait until election night. That's it, about 10 o'clock Central Time. I guess we're going to have to wait and see how the numbers come in. We should have a pretty good idea, I would think, by 10 o'clock Central Time on election night. I will remember, I'll tell you this, I had a conversation one time with John Zogby, the pollster, many years ago. And I asked him about, you know, about polling, and he said two things. Number one, it's very difficult to reach people these days because nobody answers their phone, which is true. Which is true. And the other thing he said, which really stuck with me over the years, is remember, I have a business to run. And if I keep getting it wrong, I'm not going to get new contracts. So that's the thing about polling data, that at some point, if they get it wrong and they get it wrong over and over again, that the people who pay for these polls are going to say, well, yeah, but you know, we may agree with you politically, but you're not giving us the right information. Because if they don't give you the right information, whether it's liberal or conservative, you want the right information, Bill.
That's true. And I think you made a good point that pollsters believe that more and more people are not answering their phones. And if they are answering their phones, are very wary. They read all these things about the phone systems being broken into, email being broken into, other people reading their mail. And I can understand how many of them would be very reluctant to answer some questions accurately.
Yeah. Or some people just say, it's none of your business how I vote.
That's right.
You'll find out on election day or something.
And we will.
Or something like that. And we definitely... we definitely will. But, Bill, as always, I want to thank you so much for your time and for joining us today, and have a wonderful week. We look forward to catching up with events around the world on Urgent Agenda. And thank you so much, as always, for your time, Bill.
My pleasure, Silvio, and we'll talk again in a few days, and I suspect we'll have a lot to talk about.
I think so. I think that's for sure. This time of the year. Thank you so much, Bill. Have a wonderful day.
Same to you, Silvio.
Thank you so much. Our good friend, Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda, talking about a lot of different things today with our friend Bill. Have a wonderful day, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.